The Need of Revolution. Nietzsche, the 19th century philosopher, tried to express the temper of his age in the statement, "God is dead," by which he meant that men, in his period, were losing their faith. He also cast a prophetic eye towards the future, and foretold that the 20th century would be one of wars and revolutions. His two statements were associated by a deeper logic than the inventor of the Superman philosophy knew. Men who have ceased to love God will not love their neighbors for very long, and they will find particular difficulty in trying to love that special neighbor, their enemy. This is, indeed, a century of revolutions, but it need not go down in history as a period when revolutions were entirely economic and political. There is always the possibility open to us of making ours the time of glorious revolutions, of revolutions against ourselves. A revolution is involved whenever any soul dethrones the ego which has mastered him and submits instead to the principle of love. A revolution occurs whenever humility replaces pride in us, and we abandon the foolish striving for success and notoriety. This type of homemade revolution has its pattern in the action of our Lord himself. The night before he died for the redemption of the world, he knelt before his followers as if he were least of them all. Earlier in his teaching life, he had often told them not to seek the first seats at the table, not to desire to be known among men. When the apostles disputed among themselves as to which of them was greatest, he called for a revolution in their values. He had told them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who rule over them win the name of benefactors. With you it is not to be so. No difference is to be made among you between the greatest and the youngest of all, between him who commands and him who serves. Tell me, which is greater, the man who sits at table or the man who serves him? Surely the man who sits at table, yet I am here among you as your servant." Our Lord had instituted the revolution of humility in words before. Now he put it into practice after the Last Supper, when he laid his garments aside, took a towel and put it about him, and then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the feet of his disciples, wiping them with the towel that girded him. Slaves were assigned in those days to such menial tasks as this. It was a topsy-turvy event on a gigantic scale to have the Master of Masters, the King of Kings, kneel down at 24 calloused, sweaty feet and make them clean, as his absolution still makes clean our calloused hearts and soiled souls. All human values were forever reversed in the startling revolution Christ declared in the words, "The man who exalts himself will be humbled, and the man who humbles himself will be exalted." At the moment these words were uttered, Caesar lost his throne, the principle of exploitation was undone, and arrogance and pride were shown the door. From now on, all Christians had been warned against judging as the world judges, against seeking for themselves the rewards the world can give. As water dropped from his hands that night, the old systems of morality were rendered obsolete, and the noblest concepts of the ancients became inadequate for man. From now on, the worst of all possible disorders of the soul were known. They were the failure to serve others, the accounting of oneself as being worthy of a special privilege. A new law had been born. It revealed the equality of all men before God, and went on to declare the beauty of humility. He who had humbled himself by becoming man now multiplied the gift and underscored the lesson when he reduced his infinity to the service of his servants. Revolution within the soul is the Christian adventure. It requires no hatred, demands no personal rights, claims no exalted titles, tells no lies. In such a revolution, it is love which bores from within and acts as a fifth column, loyal to God, within our tangled and disordered selves. Such a revolution destroys the pride and selfishness, the envy and jealousy, and longing to be first, which makes us intolerant of others' rights. The sword it carries is not turned against our neighbor, but against our absurd overvaluation of the self. In other revolutions, it is easy to fight, for it is against the evil enemy that we are at war. But the Christian revolution is difficult, for the enemy we must assault is a part of us. Yet this is the only revolution that ever issues in true peace. Other rebellions are never ended, for they stop short of their goal. They leave hatred still simmering in the soul of man. Contemporary thinking is directed towards a revolution in the external world of nations and classes, races and parties and cliques. But our divine Lord did not take as his first task the social revolution. He first remade individual man through the resurrection, and then, later, by sending his spirit into man, he regenerated the old world society. St. Augustine said, "They that perturb the peace they live in do it not for hate of it, but to show their power in the alteration of it." Wars come when men project their inner conflicts onto the outside world. Peace will come when many men have waged the inner revolution in which their pride is broken and their selfish ambition is destroyed. The peace that follows on such spiritual warfare can act as a happy contagion from soul to soul, bringing peace on earth to all men of goodwill.